We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Well, welcome back.
This is Hampton Keithley and Bob Brandon, and we are doing our second episode in our series on evolution. How are you today, Bob?
I'm all beat down, Hampton. I've got good. Terrible allergies going on. I get this every time of the year, you know, in the fall. And then my back hurts. I carried this big heavy stuff a couple weeks ago. My back's been bugging me. Allergies, but I'm tough, Hampton.
Yeah,
I'm gonna persevere.
Well, you're a coach, so you have to be tough.
And one of the things that's helping me get through it is I'm excited. This is one of my favorite subjects. You know, wisdom's probably my very favorite. And I've got some other really favorite subjects we can talk about off air. But as far as biblical material, evolution is such a great subject because it's so pervasive in the mindset of the populace. It's a fantastic example, actually, of the social imaginary.
Yes, we last week, Josiah and I watched the new Jurassic World movie that came out this past year.
Oh, well, I'm not a movie guy.
I know you're not a movie guy. Did you ever see the first Jurassic Park?
I saw bits and pieces,
Sam Neill, Laura Linney, Jeff Goldblum. Well, in this one, they brought the old crew into, you know, the movie with the newest cast member from the, you know, previous. And it was good. But, you know, there was just the dinosaurs 65 million years old. And, you know, there was so much evolution in there. And they got to keep repeating it so we will believe it.
It's so pervasive. Do you remember when was it, Hampton, when we were just getting to know each other? Was it 4 or 5 years ago? Maybe we went down to Denver together. You were living up at like around Carbondale at the time, and we went down to ETS.
Right.
So the Evangelical Theological Society yearly meeting, which is going to be in Denver again this fall.
It is, but it's now a 16-hour drive for me, so I'm not going to do that.
I'll probably go down there. But anyway, remember I was blown away. They had one, you know, you can divide up into whichever little section you want to go to after the plenary sessions. And so I saw in the program, there's like an evolution committee or presentation. I thought, what? And so, you know, interests me, so I went and sat in on that one. I was blown away that was even considered as a, you know, viable intellectual position. Really, that blew me away. It didn't. You've been around that stuff more than me. You've seen that creeping in, I think, but that blew me away that was considered as theologically possible.
Yeah, I can't remember who the guy was that gave the talk. It was a previous ETS. And I learned at that A-N-E doesn't stand for Ancient Near East. It stands for Adam Never Existed.
I mean, so. Jesus sure thought he did.
Yeah.
Well, we're gonna
do a book, sort of a book review, aren't we, of
We are we
Evolution's Achilles heel.
We are. We introduced Behe last time, and I need to get some feedback on that, because if that wasn't good enough, we need to do it again, because Behe's argument is it's game over for Evolution. It is not viable. Not even close. That argument is insurmountable, shuts the door. When you have an irreducibly complex system that could not have been built by evolution. That's Behe's point. And so he goes through hundreds of pages of defending that. So I hope we made that clear. We just use one example of making tubes, right? Tubulin, the right. Great protein that does that. So anyway, you know, the tail or the motile apparatus on a bacteria, like a flagellum or on a cilia, things like that, cilium. Anyway, if that wasn't clear, we need to redo it, because Behe's so powerful. But what we wanted to jump into then was, as you mentioned, a book, it's edited, right? It's called Evolution's Achilles Heels. So it's got maybe 9 chapters or so on all the subjects that pertain to evolution. And it shows all of them severely wanting. So let me just read some of the subjects in this book. There's a chapter on natural selection. We'll get into that today. There's a chapter on genetics and DNA, a chapter on the origin of life, the fossil record, the geologic record, radiometric dating, cosmology, ethics, and morality. All of those are, well, let me say it this way. Evolution is severely vulnerable on all of those issues.
Well, I think he makes the comment, if any one of those fails, the whole system collapses, and then
correct.
He proceeds to show that all 9 fail.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll bet that really surprises people. That, no, I thought, you know, dating, they had the dating down, not even close. When you really look at this, I mean, these chapters are not written by beginners, right? They're written by experts in their fields. And I think, you know, maybe one thing to point out as we barely get started here is discussions that you have with anyone, but in this case, particularly scientists, behind closed doors is often very different than discussions you have with them in public.
Right.
So to me, that's telling. I was a biology major in college, but for undergraduate stuff. And I remember asking one of my favorite professors one time, I was not a Christian at that time, and I, you know, quote, believed evolution, but again, not like an article of faith, like it is with most of the scientific community, but I, you know, just because it's the dominant paradigm. So, okay, I'll roll with that, right, at the time. And I remember asking her, it was just her and I in the room, we were cleaning up some dirty beakers or something. And I said, hey, professor, do you think we evolved? And I asked it sincerely. And she knew I was asking that sincerely. You know, she didn't perceive I had any hidden agenda or anything. And I didn't. And she just flat out said, I have no idea. There's no way she would say that in public. And that's not accusatory of her. As I think a lot of scientists are like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an honest answer. And you remember what we read last week about, it wasn't in Behe, but it was in the other book we referred to, Darwin on Trial, where the prominent British evolutionists would go to like an evolutionary morphology meeting. You know, like we're going to go to ETS or something. They go to their yearly meetings and he asks the room, is there any one thing you know that is true about evolution? And there's just dead silence. Right. That's literally a behind closed door answer.
Well, and what did you say? We should never teach this in high school was the one thing they were sure of.
That's the one thing I said, I know we shouldn't be teaching it in high school. So I really want to equip people. Let me read from Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, starting in verse 1. Now I, Paul, appeal to you personally by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. I, who am meek when present among you, but am full of courage towards you when away. Now I ask that when I'm present, I may not have to be bold with the confidence that I expect I will dare to use against some of you who consider us to be behaving according to human standards. For though we live as human beings, we do not wage war according to human standards. For the weapons of our warfare are not human weapons, but are made powerfully by God for tearing down strongholds. We tear down arguments and every arrogant obstacle that is raised up against the knowledge of God, and we take every thought captive to make it obey Christ. So evolution is maybe the dominant paradigm in all of our culture. Of course, it is within, quote, the halls of science, but I think in the culture as a whole, that's where almost everybody's coming from, right? God has been removed from our culture and our thought world, and evolution has replaced it. And that needs to be torn down by every Christian to the best of their ability. And I think the reason that we're not doing as good a job on that as we could is because it's science, and a lot of people punt when it comes to science. So,
Thinking it's too complex.
yes, you know, well, that's not what I studied in college. You know, I'm a history major or an attorney or whatever. It's not beyond any listener. You can do it. You're going to have to work to understand what's going on, but you can do it. Don't let it intimidate you. We'll try to make the concepts as simple as possible. And in fact, it really they are.
Yes, I think they are.
Right? But I don't want people to punt on this. I want you to dive in because you'll be amazed that the things that are said with absolute confidence from the scientific community into our culture are not that strong at all once you look behind the curtain. So, anyway, that's how I wanted to start out.
Yeah, well, I know in his foreword, he makes a comment. In our age, the materialist naturalist dogma rides high, brazenly confident in its assertion that it has the authority of science on its side. So that's the
Yeah,
false front that they put forth.
that's exactly right. That's the point I'm making. You
Yeah.
said it through that guy much better. And remember some of our core values. A corollary to one of our core values is good science is good. Bad science is bad. You just can't make the blanket statement, quote, science says. You got to dig in.
Right.
There are very few things that scientists believe universally and that no one questions, right? A lot of science is the process of discovering stuff. It's not a united front on all these issues. So good science is good, bad science is bad. The only thing that will keep you from understanding something is laziness. So don't be lazy. Get the books, read them. If you don't understand it, read it again
Right.
and until you do. So anyway, I'm excited about this. I'm going to persevere through my tribulations of my allergies and my bad back, Hampton. I'm going to ramp it up. Are you with me?
I am.
Okay, how about we just dive in and start reading from the foreword of this book? And then you interrupt me and make your comments as you see fit, please. So this is Dr. Carl Wieland writing the foreword. He's the managing director of Creation Ministries International in Australia, position he's held since 1987. Let me see when this little book was published. 2015. So not too long ago. And if you want further information on this stuff, the website creation.com is a good one. He runs that. So this is how he begins. In my more than 35 years of involvement in the origins controversy, there has never been anything quite like this book. So let's pause there for a second. Well, wouldn't you ex if the title says Evolution's Achilles Heels, why does he say the origins controversy? What do you think?
Well, I mean, evolution is trying to explain our origin and how we all got here.
Okay, that's fundamental to an understanding of this subject as a whole. Evolutionists ultimately are trying to say this is how we got here. There was no creator, things evolved. And that no creator part is critical to what they think. No creator. You'll see that stated in some other ways throughout these introductory chapters. So anyway, evolution ultimately is a theory of how we got here, exclusive of a creator. So nine PhD scientists, experts in various disciplines, each take on a separate area of evolutionary theory and belief. And never has it been more sorely needed. In our age, the materialist naturalist dogma rides high, brazenly confident in its assertion that it has the authority of science on its side, exactly as you said a minute ago. So, first, an explanation. The word evolution in this book's title means much more than genetic change, more even than origin of life's diversity. The term will be used to encompass the whole grand scale scenario that modern culture takes as foundational in its rejection of the creator God of the Bible, that stars, planets, and galaxies supposedly came about when nothing somehow exploded.
Yeah, I like that.
Don't you like
How can
that?
nothing explode?
That lifeless chemicals, by largely mysterious processes, are supposed to have somehow formed the first living thing, a biological machine so complex as to be able to make copies of itself and to harness usable energy from the environment. And that from this fortuitous first life has come the entire array of species, both past and present. Let's pause for a second, pick up what you were picking up on. Imagine nothing, but really imagine it. Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
I don't think you can imagine that.
And it's almost impossible to imagine. But even beginning to imagine it, how could that do anything? It can't explode. There's nothing there to explode. How could it do any? So if we came from nothing, that is, I guess I'll just say it this way, trying to be gentle about it. You know, Peter says to be gentle in your defense of the faith. So let me try to be gentle. The statement that something came from nothing is absolutely logically absurd.
Right.
That's as gently as I can say that. So every person out there that fundamentally believes that, absurd. Just absurd. You can't get something from nothing. You know who knows that more than anybody really are the physicists, because they keep trying to invent, different ways to explain the cosmos that get around that idea.
They have to start with something like hydrogen or,
You
or
have to.
whatever.
You can't start with nothing, right? So anyway, so he's making that point, and then he goes into the chapters that we'll cover moving forward. But his point is, all of these chapters, Achilles heel. Well, let's read why Achilles heels. Why did they name it that? So I think most people know who Achilles is, the great Greek hero, invincible in battle almost. And
Almost, yeah.
because of the myth, his mom, when she was born, wanted him to be invincible, so dipped him in the river Styx to protect him from everything. But she didn't get his heel in there, because that's where she held him, to dip it in the river. So that part never got protected. So he was invulnerable unless you got a spear or an arrow into his heel, and then that brought him down. So those are fun stories, but that's come down in our culture as a metaphor,
Right.
right? Of vulnerability. Like, you look like you're invulnerable, but you're not. So hence the title of the book. It looks like evolution is invulnerable in all these subject areas, but they're not. So that's his point in the next page and a half. So we've made that for him. So then let's continue with him in the next section. And this is important too. He calls this little subsection the nature of facts.
I want to back up.
Okay.
I thought it was important. He talked about the inherent circularity of the evolutionist arguments, and then he said there's a rule is that the data may only be understood and interpreted within the presuppositions of the paradigm itself.
Yeah.
And so explanations outside of nature are automatically ruled out.
Yeah. So let me give a basic example of that. Thank you, Hampton, for bringing that up. So when you say, for instance, this fossil is 500 million years old, and I might say to a presenter of that, well, how do you know it's 500 million years old? And they would say, well, because it's in this rock. And then I would say, well, how do you know how old the rock is? And then they would say, because that fossil's in it.
Right.
Literally, I've heard that dozens of times. And you just sit there with your mouth open going, well, how'd you get your degree? Because that's as circular, that is the definition of a circular argument. And
Yeah.
so that's what he's pointing out. They do that in every one of these areas, because they assume the model and then explain things according to the model. So we'll get to this section on the nature of facts. I want to make a point about this. This whole controversy, incidentally, has never been about unearthing facts for creation versus facts for evolution. I wonder if that surprises people, that the whole controversy has never been about facts. And Hampton, how many times in our earlier podcast did we refer back to Romans 1?
Yeah.
Right? It's never been about facts. Romans 1 says that, right? About God. He's made it known to people who he is. It's never been about knowledge. And I know that just sounds strange, when, because you think when you're telling someone the gospel, oh, well, they just haven't heard this. They know. According to God, they know. You know, like the responsibility was on God to make it known, and he did that. He did not drop the ball. So it's interesting. He goes on.
I think there's the impression is that science is facts, and that
Yes.
Christians are just biased.
Yeah, belief.
And
we have belief.
We have beliefs.
Facts.
And so he's pointing out that there are facts, and both sides are biased.
Yeah, I don't like the word bias, but in that case, yes, that's exactly
presuppositions.
Yes. Yeah. So then he'll get into that. When it comes to matters of history, as opposed to experimental or operational science, the science that concerns itself with how the world works, the issue's never been the facts so much as their interpretation. We all have the same world, the same facts. Those on both sides of the controversy observe the same stars, rocks, animals, and fossils, and we see the same natural selection and mutation. And philosophers of science have long reminded us that raw, uninterpreted facts never speak for themselves. As the late Harvard professor Stephen Jay Gould once wrote, facts do not speak for themselves. They're read in the light of theory. So let me present an image to people that they need to have in their mind. Because until this sinks in, you really need to contemplate this, because it'll help you understand reality and the way people function within the world. So imagine a pyramid, and this is going to represent what I'm trying to draw out is a person's map in their mind, a mental map for understanding the world. Okay, so picture a pyramid, and the top level, the smallest chunk of the pyramid, is facts. Then picture the middle section of the pyramid that's dominant, and it's called theories. And then picture the base of the pyramid, which supports the whole thing, and that would be called like presuppositions. That's how people work.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems strange at first. Wouldn't you think people would operate in such a way that facts were the dominant part of their worldview?
You would hope.
You want to be interacting sincerely with reality, not insincerely. But almost no one does that. So let's apply it to evolution. The evolutionists and the very fundamental level, so imagine the base of that pyramid, believes there's no God. That is where he's coming from.
Yeah, that's their presupposition.
That's their presupposition. And in the middle of the pyramid then is evolution. That's their theory. And then facts at the top all fit in, however much they have to twist them into that dominant picture. Okay, a creationist like me fundamentally believes God created the world. That's my presupposition. And now I would say that's a fact. That's not a presupposition, right? But for the sake of the illustration, I'll just call it a presupposition. Then my theory is, well, he made them according to their kinds, which he says in mm-hmm. Genesis 1. So, yes, do things mutate? Of course they do. Is a better adapted organism going to reproduce more than? Yes. But that doesn't change anything with creation. So every, quote, fact I come across will naturally fit. I don't have to twist it into my system. So anyway, I think people should just have that picture, that pyramid in their mind of how people are operating that you're dealing with. So then he goes on, in any case, the argument is less about the type of science that has given us so many benefits for humanity, the one that studies how the world works based on repeatable experiment and observation, than about competing beliefs about history. Objections like Genesis is not a science textbook miss the point. Genesis presents a majestic yet compact and rather straightforward eyewitness account of one-off, unobservable, and unrepeatable events, the history of the origins of life, the universe, and everything. The evolutionary notion is ultimately an idea about history, too. It is a story that tells a very different set of one-off, unobservable, and unrepeatable events. This highlights that we are in the realm of beliefs about the past when dealing with the issue of origins. It is the responsibility of every individual to determine which interpretation of the facts makes more sense of the available data. How are we doing so far, Hampton?
Yeah, that's good. And that was what I wanted to say, is that it's ironic because, you know, they say that Genesis is not a science textbook, but it's ironic that evolution is not science either.
It isn't.
It's a theory. It's a belief system. And the fact that scientists promote it gives it the false impression that it's science, but it is in fact their religion, and it's masquerading as science.
Exactly right. So anything in the next, you know, in the rest of that section, or did we cover enough of his point there? And then we move on to building models or critiquing evolution.
Let me look. I have another thing highlighted,
sure.
And it says a big problem is that while the axioms of biblical creationism are clearly stated up front on the table, as it were, the fact that the evolutionary edifice is constructed on similarly unprovable faith belief assumptions is much less widely appreciated. The biblical creationist's overt presuppositional basis is often misunderstood as a negative, since it shows how biased they are. And this may help explain why many Christians instinctively shy away from this presuppositional approach, failing to appreciate its power and usefulness in Bible science apologetics.
Yeah,
I think that's him saying what I said, but.
Yeah, and that's he's just fleshing out more that picture of the pyramid. He isn't using that picture of the pyramid right. That I presented, but that's what he's fleshing out. But let me give a concrete example of that. We'll get to this in one of the coming chapters, but in how many people's minds is the picture of the evolutionary tree? I just want people to know that's made up. That is not real. That is not what the fossil record shows.
Right.
They drew the tree and then fit those skeletons, you know, those fossils into that tree. That is not what you see when you discover a fossil. What you really see in the fossil record, the reason I'm adamant about this is the original opponents of Darwin were not the clergy. Oddly enough, the clergy kind of dropped the ball. The original opponents of Darwin were the geologists, the people looking at the fossil record going, well, that's not what we see in this fossil record. The fossil record looks exactly like what you would think it would look like if there was once a great flood that covered the earth.
Well, and I think I remember Darwin says somewhere in his book that, or one of his books, that if the fossil record doesn't, you know, we don't find these
validate
fossils,
them,
then my whole theory falls apart.
Yeah, and they never have.
And they never did, and he wouldn't admit it.
Correct. It does not look like what you see in a beginning biology textbook with that nice tree. Here's the branches. Here's where this thing. They made that. So my point in bringing up that is, the presuppositions that the evolutionist has that allows them to create that tree. But it's not reality. It's not what's in the ground when you go dig up a fossil. It's not a nice tree like that. It's skeletons scattered everywhere.
Yeah.
How about this phrase? Oh, have you ever heard this phrase tossed around in these discussions? The Cambrian explosion?
Uh-huh.
Oh, does that sound like evolution? Explosion? All of a sudden you have all these preformed fossils? That's not evolution. Well, whose term is that? That's their term, mm-hmm. not mine. I'm telling you, the fossil record looks nothing like the way they present it. Anyway, back to our author here. You can tell Hampton I get riled up about this stuff. You gotta try to mellow me out a little bit. Remind me that my back is bothering me.
Okay, slow down. So where are we, building models or critiquing evolution?
Yes. So let me begin with that. As important as creationist model building and model refining is, though, evolution's Achilles' heels is not primarily about that. Its focus is unashamedly on critiquing evolution. Granted, believers are not supposed to be argumentative and objectionable in giving reasons for what we believe. We are to do so with gentleness and respect, 1 Peter 3:15. But we are supposed to demolish arguments that are set up in opposition to God. This is how the Apostle Paul described that aspect of the mission of the followers of Jesus in 2 Corinthians 10:5, which we read. So I actually don't think there's anything wrong with being passionate about your subject. I don't want to be disrespectful, and I do want to be gentle, but I also don't want to lose my passion.
Right.
So,
well, he goes on to say after that, besides being a false view of history, the stranglehold of evolutionism on public thought is profound and is a huge barrier to the gospel for millions.
Yeah.
And I think that's a key thought.
Yeah.
Because if you don't believe there's a God that created you, then you're not going to be responsible to him. And that's, you know, the root motivation for accepting evolution is, it's not true what Dawkins said in The Blind Watchmaker, that Darwin made it intellectually, made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist.
Yeah.
But yeah. It sounds good, and so people believe it.
Yeah, I had a, just to make this personal, and then we'll finish out this forward here. We'll go over to the next section. You can critique me on this, you know, sincerely critique me, because I'm not sure I'm right about this. I sort of think I am in my gut, but I'm open to being advised. So I gave this presentation once, I forget how many years ago now, I don't know, maybe 10 years or so, at the, what's it called? The something for Christian scholars. You know, it's a worldwide organization.
Okay.
Institute for Christian Scholars or something like that. So the conference was in Kansas City, and I presented a paper on how the devil works in academia. And I thought, you know, no one's going to come to this. And the room was packed.
Oh, yeah.
And literally it was standing room. They couldn't let any more people in. And I started getting scared, like, oh my gosh, I didn't think anyone was going to come to this. So yeah, I presented my material. And in the course of that, I get into more of the story at a later time. It's really kind of funny now. But anyway, there was a Japanese biology professor, and he was in the front row, and he was telling me that his father, who was also a biology professor in Japan, had come to faith, but he still believed in evolution. And I said, well, then your father hasn't come to faith. And I don't know if I'm right in that. But what I said was, you again have to hear the whole presentation to understand where I was coming from. But I said, God said he made the animal kinds. If your father believes in evolution, which is claiming that God didn't do it, that it evolved, I said, then your father doesn't believe God. And that means he hasn't come to faith. Based on Genesis 15:6, right? Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as. So anyway, oh boy,
He didn't like that.
no one in that room liked that. And it became a big brouhaha, and we were saved only by the bell. But that's where I'm coming from. And I'm open to advisement, but I don't see how you can believe both those things. You
Yeah.
can't, right?
I understand.
So you advise me over time. We don't have to settle that right now, but let's finish out this last section here on the foreword. A corollary, so we're under creation or evolution. Is there a third option? A corollary to this notion that one should not be attacking evolution, but rather strengthening creation, is the complaint that undermining evolution is not necessarily demonstrating biblical creation anyhow. However, I don't, I that flies in the face of 2 Corinthians 10, but anyway. However, just as the concept of evolution is far broader than just the neo-Darwinian concept of and mechanism for universal common descent, so too one needs to step back a little to appreciate the fundamental nature of this controversy. At the end of the day, there really are only two options. Either the world was made or it made itself. I agree 100% with that.
Right.
Okay. If it was not made, then hydrogen, hold on, you can't even say that. Hydrogen is something. If there was nothing, you can't create something. But anyway, to carry out his argument, if it is not made, then hydrogen is a gas which not only has appeared from nothing, but left to itself has turned into people and everything else. If it was made, then we're talking about a making entity, in other words, a creator. That, by definition, is so stupendous that the only viable candidate really is the infinite personal God of the Judeo-Christian Bible. By invoking the philosophical law of the excluded middle, one can truly say that the credibility of Genesis, of the Genesis account, is greatly strengthened by identifying and exposing the Achilles heels of grand scale evolution, by definition. I think he's right. Here's how you say it on the street. There's only two games in town.
Yeah.
If you eliminate one of the games, there's only one left. So that's what he was trying to say there. So those who have been used to seeing the commonly repeated criticisms of creation may be surprised to see just how seriously deficient the case for evolution is overall. In fact, many of the assumptions underlying evolutionism within the various subject areas fly in the face of known scientific laws and principles in physics, chemistry, and probability. So keep this in mind. So that's the end of the foreword. We've said this before, but it bears repeating. In the context of a university, you actually find a greater percentage of believing Christians in the hard sciences, in chemistry, physics, biology, and so on, as opposed to the humanities. Right? The humanities are just where all the spin doctors live. But you actually find more believers in the hard sciences. Why is that? Because they're dealing with reality. And when you deal with reality, that ultimately leads you to God.
Yeah.
It's an interesting way to think about it. Do we have time to get started on natural selection?
Actually, I don't think we should. We've probably been going 50 minutes, so we ought
Already, you rabbit trailed me that
to.
many times.
No, there was just a lot of good stuff in that forward.
I agree. And it's almost like, I said this to you before we started. It's almost as if you need to go through the book and then read the foreword again to let, and that stuff will sink in even deeper on how presuppositional evolution really is.
Yeah.
But I'm okay if you want to call it
Well,
here and we'll crank up the next chapter next time.
okay. Well, that was good. I guess we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Hampton. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.